Pragmatism is a home-born philosophy, and one which is peculiarly suited to the American temperament. It was developed at the turn of the century by Charles Peirce and John Dewey and William James. Pragmatism says essentially that the truth of a proposition inheres in its potential consequences. There is no such thing as a self-encased truth, as a set group of ideologies which are totally consistent in and of themselves. One judges truth not by the neatness with which one's judgment corresponds to somebody's revelation or somebody's doctrine, but by the efficiency, the effectiveness with which that judgment leads to certain practical consequences. Truth is that which works. Now, the classic example of political pragmatism is the New Deal. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected at the depth of the Depression, and when his mandate was to get the American economy moving again, to see to it that we would construct those rules and those laws which would prevent such a catastrophe from happening another time. He didn't go to the library and take down Thorsten Veblen or Karl Marx and then indict his proposed legislation on the basis of these set theories. Nor did he look up any particular dialectic or ism. Rather, he got together Mr. Morgenthau and Mrs. Perkins and the Brain Trust, and they gathered together the facts, and they defined the problem as neatly and completely as they could. They weighed alternatives, and then very pragmatically they wrote out the WPA and the CCC and the AAA and the NRA legislation, which achieved the desired goal. Now, this kind of pragmatic humanism, or pragmatic liberalism, have it as you will, has been essentially the mainstream of American political and social reform. And we've been rather proud of it. We've avoided revolution. We've avoided great divisiveness in our society. We felt that it suited the natural temperament. After all, we were a nation of tinkerers and experimenters and research people. We looked upon the ideologues, those who were bound to their isms, as narrow men. They belonged on another continent where older ways, less adequate ways were used. They were trying to force life with all of its jagged edges and its incongruities into a neat intellectual box, and life won't fit. The beginning of this decade, we smiled rather smugly when Mao Tse-tung, Chairman Mao, had to call off the Great Leap Forward, an attempt to forcefully industrialize the commune because the Chinese peasants simply refused mulishly to agree to that particular element in the Marxian dialectic. We felt ourselves superior. We had a way of political reform which was, in a sense, guaranteed by past success. We were pragmatists. I'm proud of it. Now, I speak of pragmatism this morning and of this traditional way of approaching our social problems because the 1960s represent essentially a crisis in the pragmatic faith. For the first time in many decades, we in America were faced by those in the universities, in the economic sphere, the young, more militant in the minority communities who said to us, pragmatism doesn't work, pragmatism cannot work, it's always laggardly, it's too slow, too lugubrious to meet the challenging revolutionary changes which are part of the warp and woof of modern life. We need a more radical, a more revolutionary, if you will, solution. We need to go beyond due process, to go beyond legislative reform, to go beyond commissions and long reports and the long, difficult way of going from the report to legislation, to the trial of legislation in the courts, to their actual empowerment. And I'd like to judge these last 10 years with you, to look them over precisely from this point of view. How did America meet this crisis of faith? What lies ahead, given the crisis of faith? The 1960s began, much as had the 1950s and the decades before, with America pretty well convinced that we were on the road somehow towards creating that prosperous, industrial, humane, democratic, technological state where there would be opportunity for all. We were proud of our machinery. We were arrogant about our technology. We were confident that more and more people were coming into the sunlight of American abundance. We looked forward to even more social reform. And in that first year of the 1960s, we elected to the presidency of the United States a very attractive, personable young man who talked to us about America's unfinished business, about a great society. He talked to us in familiar terms, with a sense of urgency, to be sure. But he reminded us of the other America, the more than 30 million Americans who lived below the poverty line. And he talked to us of colored America, of the Mexican-American, of the Indian, of the Puerto Rican, and of the black, most of whom were in poverty, but all of whom suffered any number of disadvantages and disabilities simply because of their color. They were not in the establishment. They were not in our neighborhoods. They were not in our schools. They were not allowed to rise in many areas of the business and political world. He talked to us of the forgotten America, of the aging and the elderly, a growing group in our population who lacked security, who lacked health insurance, who lacked the institutions which would provide them an agreeable old age. He talked to us of the need for urban renewal. He talked to us of the great shadow of pollution, which was beginning to shed its ugliness over the land. And many Americans responded very well to this young man and to his challenge. It was in the American mainstream. We had come this far. There was more to do. And by God, we would do it. So John F. Kennedy was elected President of the United States, and he set about bringing into being task forces of very intelligent, very sophisticated men and women who met and analyzed each and every one of the problem areas of our society and proposed to the administration what was needed. The administration drafted resolutions, but because his election had been largely an election of personalities rather than an election of parties, he was not able during his years in office to effect, to pass the legislation of the Great Society. And then he was shot. And then his vice president became his successor. And his vice president, his successor, was a more adroit politician. And he was able in two remarkable years, 1964 and 1965, to pass most of the legislation of the Great Society, except it was called now the Fair Deal. And you know, it was truly a remarkable set of rules and of social reforms. We had the Economic Opportunities Act, the basic piece of legislation of the war on poverty. Everything was in it, from Head Start to the job opportunity centers to job retraining to urban renewal. We created a Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to be at the pivot and at the core in Washington of all of these now ramified and ramifying activities. We passed Medicare, the first major step in America to provide health insurance for the aging. We passed the first Federal Aid to Education Act. We passed an Education Act for elementary and secondary education. We passed two Civil Rights Acts. We passed a voters' reform bill, which stripped from the registrars in the counties of the South the power to set up qualifying tests, which precluded the black from being enrolled on the registers of those qualified to vote. In 2 years, America was able to bring into being a new series of regulations which promised to meet many of the needs of the hour to move America forward with some degree of dispatch. And Mr. Johnson did not have to suffer as Mr. Roosevelt had done in the days of the 1930s from a recalcitrant court. The Supreme Court did not, during the 1960s, strike down any single major provision of this new economic and social legislation as unconstitutional. The legislation was passed, the legislation came into being, and it fell flat on its face. The question is why? What happened? What do I mean by when I say that it fell flat on its face? Well, this is 1969, not 1960. 10 years, 5 years after the passage of the Fair Deal. And what happened? We have more elderly who cannot maintain themselves in dignity than we had 10 years ago. There are more children in the average classroom in the public school systems than there were 10 years ago. There are less doctors and less hospital beds per thousand in our population than there were 10 years ago. 2 out of 3 of the minority groups who come to maturity in the ghettos of our center cities between the ages of 19 and 24 are still unemployed, precisely the number that were unemployed 10 years ago. There is 2, 3, 4 times the amount of violence in our cities that there were 10 years ago. And we can see this seething frustration in the population itself. These have been years of burning, years of the gun, years of violence, years of Watts, Huff, Newark, Detroit, the capital of Washington, D.C. itself, going up in flames. Years in which Cleveland has come from a relatively safe community to one in which there is literally a murder a day. A decade in which a president was assassinated, the greatest apostle in our land of nonviolence was assassinated, a refreshing young presidential candidate assassinated. Across the land, the voice of violence, the voice of radicalism, the voice of urgent concern, of deep frustration, was making itself heard. What happened? We passed the new frontier legislation, the Fair Deal legislation. We failed to fund it. We brought it into being. We helped men to feel that there was hope. We buoyed up their confidence. And then we failed to provide the dollars that were necessary. When Mr. Nixon campaigned during this last year for the election as President of the United States, he claimed that the Fair Deal legislation failed because it was ill-conceived, because it continued what he called the dole, because it was simply piled on levels of bureaucracy, one on top of the other. I doubt it. There is no perfect legislation. But I fundamentally believe that the new frontier, the great society, the Fair Deal failed because we never gave it a chance. We never gave it the funds to grow beyond its initial first year. It was passed in 64 and in 65, and by 1965, the same president who had fought for the Fair Deal was telling health, education, and welfare, was telling the Council of Economic Opportunities, there is no more money than the money that you were originally given. Pull back. Retrench. I need the money for Vietnam. I need it for guns. I need it for fighting. And there were many in this country during these years who were not at all surprised that this was the fate of this kind of pragmatic social reform. There were many who said, a society cannot reform itself through the democratic process. People will not voluntarily give up their special privilege. A privileged class will only give to the underprivileged enough to keep them quiescent and passive. It'll never give them adequacy, decency, full rights in the society. And they could cite chapter and verse. When the Economic Opportunities Act was passed, they were included in it and in all of its parts a provision which required maximum feasible participation of the clients, of the poor, in the decision-making processes of how various funds were to be distributed on the boards which were to manage the neighborhood opportunity centers and the like. And from that day to this, there's been protracted warfare in our society between local governments, county governments, state governments, federal bureaus, and the poor. All of the levels of government being unwilling to bring the poor themselves into the establishment, into decision-making roles. Yes, the dole, yes, charity. But we don't want to build up in this councilman's ward, in this community, a group of sophisticated people who control patronage and power, who will limit the power which we now enjoy and will cut into the patronage which we now dispense. America was not of a mind, really, to move beyond the 1960 ordering of society and to allow the minority groups particularly, the black particularly, to come into the mainstream of American life. And those who made this critical assessment of the reforming process, of the traditional pragmatic processes of our society, said, we're not surprised. We predicted this. A society, power is never given. Power must be taken. And so we saw during the 1960s, black power and brown power and poor power. The attempts by all of those whom we had denied the opportunity which we had promised them to organize themselves to take what the society apparently was unwilling to give. In 1965, on a road in Mississippi, during James Meredith's march through Mississippi, Martin Luther King was walking along with Stokely Carmichael, and Carmichael violated a pledge he had made to Mr. King, and he began to harangue of black power. He'd caught the mood, a mood which grew when King himself was assassinated, a mood in the black community which said, enough, we've waited long enough. We've gone through the traditional processes, through the NAACP and through the Urban League. We've tried legal redress. We've cooperated with white liberals for civil rights legislation, but it's tokenism. We want black capitalism. We want black communities. We want black power, and we want it now. 1960 was the year of the now. And on campuses throughout the land, young people rose up, and they began to point the finger at every one of the inconsistencies in the American society where we had failed to give justice. The grape pickers and the Indians and the Eskimos and the colored and the black. And they spoke of the indignities of the poor. And they began to develop methods of confrontation, methods of demonstration, methods of mass congregation. Message which drew attention of every American to every one of the social ills which existed in the society. There was youth power, and there was peace power, and there was black power, and there was poor power. We saw during the 1960s the first organization that I can remember in American life of people by economic class in Cleveland and elsewhere. The poor, black and white, Puerto Rican and Mexican, met, and they came together in welfare rights groups, and they demonstrated at the welfare office, and they demonstrated in Columbus, and they became more and more radical as the society provided less and less dignity. It took 4 years for the federal government during the 1960s to pass legislation which would allow children and families where the father was unemployed but living within the families to receive supplementary aid, the aid to dependent children of the unemployed. It took the state of Ohio 4 more years to come up with legislation which would give the 10 cents on the dollar was the federal government required the states to give as their appropriation, as their part of this aid to dependent children of unemployed parents in order to affect it in Ohio. Public welfare in Ohio is still given at 80% of the funds necessary for minimal subsistence. So there was the organization, the welfare rights groups, there was the organization of the black, there was the organization of the brown, there was the organization of the young, all of them arguing that the society had defaulted. The traditional society had failed to live up to its own self-proclaimed promise of justice and equal opportunity for all. And the society, you and I, were bemused. We weren't quite sure what had happened. We heard strident voices. We heard language which seemed to us outlandish. We saw demonstrations whose purpose we could not fully comprehend. We saw the frustration, we understood that. But we wondered about the radical techniques. What we failed to understand is that these techniques were ends in and of themselves, that there was no total program, there could not be, because radicalism is born of frustration. And we, the establishment, were those who had frustrated. This was our generation. The best of us failed to understand the urgency of the domestic crisis. When John F. Kennedy was elected to office, you remember how he cried out the challenge, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And so many of the young particularly responded. But Kennedy himself, though he understood the problem, didn't understand its urgency. He knew the need of a great society, but it seemed to him that there were overwhelming needs. Foreign policy, the Cold War, Cuba. And so when the young people volunteered, what did he do? Did he organize them for the farms of Mississippi or for the slums of Cleveland and Chicago? Not at all. He organized them into the Peace Corps for the towns and slums of Costa Rica, Burma, and India. Now, much good could be done abroad, to be sure. It needed to be done. But there were urgent home problems. And it took a long time into the mid-decade before Americans began to realize the depth of the crisis which we ourselves faced here and now. In a State of the Union address in January of 1965, Mr. Johnson said to the country, the time has come where though we will have international problems to deal with, we can turn our major attention to the concerns of the American character. And that was the year in which most of the important Fair Deal legislation was passed, but that was the same year in which Mr. Johnson escalated our involvement in Vietnam from 23,000 people to 200,000 soldiers, the same year in which he sent 12,000 soldiers into Thailand. He believed that America, because so many people had talked of our prosperity and of our power, could fight in Southeast Asia and could fight a war on poverty and win both. And in fact, he lost both. We don't have unlimited wealth. We do not have unlimited power. There are certain priorities even the richest and most powerful nation on earth must make pragmatic judgments, and we were unwilling to make them. We believed that we were living on top of the world, that there was no need to choose between alternatives, and no choice was made, and therefore, very little progress. We lacked leadership during the 1960s. We spoke the words, all of us. We knew what was needed, all of us. There's no mystery to it. But it somehow never translated into effective action. Why? Well, the politicians and we tend to blame it on Vietnam. Now, Vietnam was a tragedy beyond description. $200 billion of treasure have been poured into that jungle swamp with nothing to show for it except 35,000 casualties, more casualties than America suffered during the First World War. But Vietnam is a symptom, not the disease. There were no leaders, because a successful politician understands the temper of the people, and because the people were not about to be led. Something has happened to the American character in the last two decades or so. We've become piggish. We've become self-centered. We've become self-involved. Our cinema, our theater, our writing during the 1960s became vulgar, a direct mirror image, I submit, of the growing vulgarity in our own lives. The sanctity of marriage, the sanctity of family, the dignity of person, they're ticked off as nothing in our society today. We became concerned with getting and gaining and having and ingesting and spending and enjoying. What does it mean when the commentators say that there is now a taxpayers' revolt against new appropriations for education and social reform? It means that the average man wants his keg of beer rather than better education for his school. He won't give up the one for the other. It means that you and I want our $8,000 sports car and its monthly payments more than we want peace in our city and justice for our community. How many of you have had the experience that I have had at social gatherings to talk to a man or a woman who's wearing on them clothes which cost more than the entire food and housing budget of a family for a year, talking about the great social issues of the day with utmost concern, without any recognition of the incongruity of what's happening? America has been mesmerized by the good society, the good life. We've lived through an era of conspicuous consumption. We don't seem to be through with it. Our appetites have been stimulated and they're proving to be insatiable, and we can yet be eaten up by them. The politicians led during the 1960s where the people were prepared to lead, to the pig trough. We called, some of us were called pigs during 1960 by the frustrated. All of us are pigs. We've become that. We've developed multi-million-dollar industries to stimulate our appetites, as if they're not naturally voracious enough. We've lived without any sense of commitment, any real basic sense of sacrifice. Who has sacrificed what and how much? It's no sacrifice to sit around a fine meal at a luncheon committee downtown to solve the problems of the city. How much have we sacrificed? You and I and every citizen in this land. Pragmatism did not fail during the 1960s. We did. We failed the very hopeful, reformist, liberal tradition which has meant so much to our nation. And that failure, unless we turn it around, and yet prove a terribly costly one. Because we live in a generation now where no one will accept second-class citizenship, where no one will accept ostracism, where no one will accept living in inadequacy when so many live in luxury, when everyone demands his place in the sun, a decent, adequate education for his children, food for his belly, food for his family, job for his livelihood, a job for his mental health. Decency. Will it be revolution? Will it be radicalism? Will it be violence? It need not be. It may be. The choice is ours. It's a choice between principle and pocketbook. It's a choice between self-involvement and citizenship. It's a choice between satiety and sacrifice. The choice is clear. The time is urgent. Violence is abroad in our land. You and I walked easily through this city of Cleveland 10 years ago. We walk fearfully. We leave the main streets today. You and I walked proudly as Americans during the last two decades or so. Each of us bears today some burden of concern and shame. It's not enough to damn the ideologues. It's not enough to condemn the futility and the triviality and the pure destructiveness of the young radicals. What we have to do is to cure the social cancer which is foistering and festering, which brings out this poison in the body politic. And it's going to require surgery, and that's all that I'm trying to say to you this morning. It's going to require surgery, the kind of surgery that the prophet Jeremiah suggested to Israel 3,000 years ago. His generation, too, Israel had a fat heart. Its heart was covered with greed and with appetite and selfish concern. And he said, circumcise your hearts. Scrape away the scar tissue. Scrape away the greed. Expose your heart. Feel again. Care. Be concerned. Recognize that you live in dangerous times. But you can't go on simply planning for a secure tomorrow. We too need a new heart. We're capable of it. America has the machinery, and America has the skills, and America has the wealth to do anything that she wants to on the domestic scene. Will we? I pray we will.